As concerns American Indians and the relevance of the term genocide to understanding the historical interactions between the incoming invading settler population on the one hand and indigenous people on the other. Whether it's inappropriate, shrill, distortive, and so forth, as Lynn Cheney and William Bennett and Arthur Schlesinger and Bill Buckley and a few others that I could name, good Americans all, or whether it's clinically precise, might be addressed by two words. And those two words are scalp bounties. And what's a scalp bounty? It's a matter of official policy promulgated in every antecedent East Coast colony of the European powers, every state of the Union after the decolonization of the 13 Atlantic Coast colonies creates the United States. Every single territory and subsequent state of the United States, with the exceptions of Alaska and Hawaii, at some point in their history, promulgation, that is, of a policy that said that a citizen producing the scalp, and in some cases the bloody red skin, of an adult male Indian would be paid, if you take Pennsylvania colony in, say, 1740 as an example, the equivalent of the annual wage of your average farmer for that proof of death. Of an Indian male, any Indian male, didn't matter who, killed simply on basis of membership in group, matter of official policy. 40 pounds sterling, that's the equivalency of the annual wage. Adult female Indian, 20 pounds sterling, killed two women, annual wage. 10 pounds sterling for a child. Child be defined as any human being of either sex under 12 years of age down to and including fetus. And there are cases on record where professional scalp hunters did kill pregnant women, open their bellies, scalp the fetus, collect twice. This was a profession. And Indians were being hunted and killed as a matter of policy throughout the Anglo-American portion of North America for several centuries. First of these were promulgated in the mid-1600s. The one in Texas went out in 1881. They say it wasn't a matter of central U.S. government policy to maintain these things. That's true. It's also a shell game. State of California, for example, paid the bounty for a period of time, okay, out of its own treasury, which is, of course, not the central government of the United States, and then petitioned the government to compensate it for its expenditures and was compensated out of the federal treasury. So it's simply an accounting procedure that buffers the federal government of the United States from maintaining as its own policy. And that's as straightforward as even the strictest definer or equator of genocide to killing, official policy, arbitrariness, and so forth can make it. It meets every criteria being genocidal policy and thereby makes genocide an absolutely precise analytical tool for understanding the dynamics of, well, as they call it, colonial period, as if somehow or another the United States being ushered in made it a non-colonial or post-colonial period, okay? The thrust of post-invasion America and the historical dynamics. This is not in its totality, but it's a missing element without which you cannot actually understand the nature of the process by which things went from point A when they hit the beach over at Jamestown to point B, which is where we find ourselves today. To leave that out and the implications of that out is to profoundly misunderstand the nature of the process, and in that misunderstanding render ourselves unable to define the phenomena which is the nature of our existence and thereby to prevent us from effectively forming strategies to change it. Well, that would come under both the Klan activities and the scalp bounties would come under something known as direct killing. Under killing, Lemkin had two parts, direct killing being where you do something like go out and collect a scalp bounty, where you go out and do something like lynch, where you do something like form an Einsatz group and just machine gun the population. Direct killing. But that's not the only form of killing. Now, these tend to be kind of like a Venn diagram, in that one bleeds into the next in terms of the categories. They're not easily segregable or distinguishable from one from another. So we're going to have some overlap here. The second element of killing, and he says this is the much more pervasive one, has to do with the imposition of slow death measures, and that is where you withdraw the ability of people to subsist, to sustain themselves, where they ultimately end up dying in destitution of things like malnutrition, starvation, exposure to the elements, disease for lack of medical attention, so on, so on, and so on. Let's just suffice to say for the moment that the aggregate conditions afflicting native North America, whether you're in Canada way up north, or whether you're in Canada down in the more civilized zone along the border, or whether you're in the U.S. portion, and whether you're east or you're west, or you're north or you're south in the United States, the overall conditions of the entire indigenous population in North America are such that if you are a reservation-based American Indian male, you have a life expectancy in the year 2001 of less than 50 years. The number I hear most commonly is 44.6. I've had that argued with by people who are real concerned with precision in these things, and they've said they live about 2 years longer than that. Okay, then make it 46.6. It's irrelevant to me. Either way, there doesn't seem to be much contest on the fact that the life expectancy of reservation-based American Indian women is 3 years longer than the men, creating the misimpression that women are doing better than men. But now you make the comparison to GPOP average longevity, you find men experiencing 71.8 years and women live at 8 years on average longer than men in the GPOP, which means proportionally American Indian women are doing even worse than the men as compared to their mainstream sisters. And aggregating that into a general average, what you find is that every time an American Indian dies on a reservation at the end of the 20th century, one-third of a lifetime just got lost. Or you can flip that over, because that's not new data. It went on throughout the 20th century, generation in, generation out. Since it's intergenerational, you can make with equal accuracy the observation that every time an American Indian baby is born in a reservation context, you're in the process of losing one-third of lifetime. And one-third population attrition, because this is across the board, is genocidal in terms of its lethal effect by any definition you wish to use. And that's a long-standing, policy-driven situation.